The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Ranger Bob becomes a sergeant. Vince toggles mechanical mechanisms to bootstrap. Enlightened lightens the cognitive load. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enlighten your way ahead. Executives, understand where you are going, why, and how to get there, make better decisions through independent expert advice, and understand how the world is changing. Knights of the Realm, bring prosperity to you and your enterprise, realize the pitfalls you face and how to avoid them, and expand your influence and alternatives. Independents, stay ahead of the curve to understand your future, better serve your customers to expand your situation, and improve your skills and the world as it changes. Enlighten, events that fascinate and inform. At ELN3.com.
Coming up on April 16th in San Francisco, Enlighten will have an all-day event featuring high-tech companies pitching to investors, panels and discussions on countering disinformation campaigns that are disrupting modern society, practice enterprise sales pitches for companies selling their cyber stuff with enterprise buyers and analysts critiquing them, a tabletop exercise involving executive decisions in the context of an advanced attack methodology. You can watch, join a panel, have a seat on the board, pitch your company to investors or customers, and get feedback and scores. Sign up for San Francisco April 16th at ELN3.com.
Enlighten. Events that fascinate and inform.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Lazaro, welcome to The Cyber Show. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Craig? Thank you for inviting me.
I'm doing just fine. So you're here from, what's the name of the company and tell us what it does?
So at this point, the company name is DLHRT. And we are building a medical device that is called iEcho 24.
All right. What does iEcho 24 do that no other medical device is going to do?
So iEcho 24 is going to solve a big problem in the medical field, because for the most part, patients in critical care, ICU or emergency room.
Hang on. When we use abbreviations on the show, we spell them out. ICU is intensive care unit. So yeah. In the ICU or intensive care.
With patients in the intensive care unit and emergency department, they are continuously monitored. However, the current monitor data that people use to follow these patients are not enough to predict cardiac deterioration and death. So iEcho 24 is going to solve that problem, because it is basically an ultrasound machine that you connect to the patient in the bedside and will give you a continuous image of the heart in real time.
But hang on. So it gives you a continuous image. And that's, of course, there's a lot of cyber in there, right? Just having the ultrasound machine, that's a complicated electronic process. It does all sorts of image processing and so forth. But what you do is much better than that. It's not just, it's not like a person has to sit there and look at it. What do you do beyond that?
Yeah. So the provider will be able, for the first time, to set up an alarm that alerts the provider when the ventricular function starts to decline. So for the most part, the heart is an organ that when it starts to decline the function, physicians are not able to detect. And sometimes it's too late.
When you say they're not able to detect, right now what you have is the, the thing that you see on the medical shows with the line going across going ba-dum, 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 right? And but now you're taking an ultrasound in real time. So watching the heart, what can you tell by watching the heart that you can't tell by the other stuff?
Yeah. So when the heart function starts to decline, the body develops a compensation. And everything that you look at in the monitor, like an electrocardiogram, the blood pressure, and any other parameter that we monitor today are compensated. And they look normal to your eyes. But in reality, the heart function is declining over time. And you are completely blind to that phenomenon.
So tell me how the ultrasound changes that. What is it by looking at the ultrasound of the heart? What changes that tells you, wait a minute, something's going bad here?
Yeah. So the device will calculate automatically the ventricular ejection fraction. So that's the amount of blood.
Right, hang on. Say it again slowly. The ventricular
ejection fraction.
That's how much it's pushing out, right? How much blood it's pushing
out? Exactly. Yeah. And the value is a percentage. So at the beginning, when you set up this device in the patient, you calculate the baseline ejection fraction. And anytime the machine calculates the ejection fraction automatically, it will tell you if the ejection fraction is above or below the baseline. If it is below the baseline, it will alert the provider. And when it reaches the critical value that you set up for the alarm, it will give you an alarm, a sound alarm, or a text message to the provider so they can act accordingly.
If it gets higher, is that bad as well? If it's ejecting more, or is that just normal?
No, if it is equal or above the baseline, the device will continue calculating. Usually the way it's going to be set up is the device will calculate for 1 minute. And if it is the same or above the baseline, it will go to sleep again. And if it is below the baseline, will alert the provider. And if it is critical, then we'll give you an alarm. That's the way it's going to work.
So it looks every minute. Is that right?
Yeah. So depending on how sick the patient is, you can set up the device to wake up every 1 hour and record for 5-10 minutes, calculate the ejection fraction and other parameters as well. And then if everything is fine, it goes to sleep.
If it's plugged into the wall, why does it have to go to sleep? Why not just keep it running all the time? So if it ever happens, you'll know right away.
Well, the problem is that first, you don't need to have a continuous 24/7 depending how critical the patient is. If the patient is extremely ill, you can have it for more time. But the problem is that we try to prevent the transducer to be all the time working because of the heating. So we don't know yet what would be the critical temperature that will reach the transducer, but the device has the protection that if the transducer reaches a certain temperature, it will go to sleep automatically. But I don't think we need to have the device working at a time for more than 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, all right. But I'm just sort of looking towards the future here. So you could either add cooling to keep the sensor from being, because it's all outside the body, right? This isn't inside the body.
Yeah. And we are just speculating because the transducer that we are building is so special that it's different to the current technology where only the acoustic stack will be in contact with the gel. So the gel and the skin. So our theory is the gel will cool down any heating of the transducer, which we are not expecting any significant heat. So, but again, depending on the severity of the disease, the physician can determine for how long they want the device working at a time. The other cool feature, Fred, of this device is, let's say if the device is sleeping, is in a sleep mode, and the patient develop some kind of changes in the disease, there will be sensors that will wake the device up, and the device could start recording right away.
I got it. So there are other sensors that are looking for things that will wake the device. So, you know, for me, maybe I'm just whack, you know, I sort of think if you're going to go that route, you might as well just have it looking all the time, right? So continuously looking, because you never know what you're going to learn from watching it all the time, right?
Correct. And we don't know. As physician, I can tell you, if you ask me, what is the normal heart rate during...
Lazaro, you're a physician, right?
Yeah.
Well, so I'm going to ask you, what is the normal heart rate? You said I could ask, and I figured I would.
Yeah, the normal heart rate is between 60 and 80 beats per minute. But what I'm saying here is that the human has a variation of the heart rate during 24 hours, as well as the blood pressure. If you check the blood pressure continuously, it changes over time. It's a circadian rhythm. But we don't know what is the normal variation for the ejection fraction. So this is the first time that we are going to learn how the ejection fraction changes over time in a normal human being, because this has never been implemented before.
Fantastic. So now, if we keep it running 24/7, we're going to get basically a movie of how the ejection changes with time, when you're sleeping, when you're sitting up, everything about it, when you're sick, when you're getting better. So that should provide an enormous amount of data to help us better understand what causes cardiac induced deaths, right?
And the other thing that is very cool, and the physicians are already know about this, is they will learn for the first time how the medication that we use in critical care affect the ejection fraction. We don't know that.
Okay, so what you're saying is today we push medicine in and we say, well, the heart started beating okay again. I guess we're okay. But now you're going to be able to look at, you know, what the dosage is and how it affects the actual functioning of it. Wow, okay. This is a big difference.
Exactly.
Okay, fantastic. Indeed. All right, so you must have a lot of physicians, especially cardiac specialists that are interested in this. Is that who your investment base is?
Yeah, so far they have been my investors. They see it is a great potential that can change the way they practice today. And invest on this, definitely.
So anybody out there who's a cardiac specialist who hears the show, you can get in touch with Lazaro. If you go to thecybershow.co, you'll just click on the link for iECHO 24, and I'll have something that says, continuous cardiac. I don't know what it'll say, but just click there and you can see his GWiz that describes the details of the company. And he's seeking investment, but we can't give investment details out over the air because you're not necessarily an accredited investor. Well, I think most physicians will meet the criteria, though. Lazaro, thank you so much. Fascinating new technology. Clearly, the cyber world is eventually going to solve lots and lots of medical problems, and you're, dead center of this field. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred. Appreciate it.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. For a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. LinkedIn seems to be using automated lie generators to teach users not to give away personal information. But the automatic liars are both stupid and disruptive to legitimate users. Stop using stupid security tricks on your users. Don't waste time abusing your users for security, or you will become breaking news on the Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the 5 ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. This is a recent LinkedIn exchange I had that I thought you might find interesting. I'm represented by the wonderful-sounding British male voice.
Thursday, Fanny Lee sent the following message at 9:02 a.m.
Nice to meet you on LinkedIn. My boss saw your profile and wants to talk to you. Please tell us your contact information and the best time to contact you. Can my boss contact you personally? Sincerely.
Have your boss message me directly here.
My employer is from Germany and has been living there for a short time. She rarely logs into LinkedIn. So I arranged for me to find people in this field on LinkedIn to communicate and learn. There may be possibilities for cooperation in the future. My employer's name is Zemila, a freelance investor. Another identity is the chief marketing officer of Merck. He just left his job and is currently looking for emerging investment opportunities in the United States.
She, he, Zemila, I arranged for me.
Fine. Please provide his email address and I will email him directly.
My employer is currently on a flight to New York. How about you leave your contact number and email and I will arrange for her to contact you.
How about you talk to your employer after he arrives?
Okay, Fred. If you can leave your contact information at your convenience now, I'll refer it to my boss, Ms. Anna, so she can contact the bar.
He is a she named Mazana, and something about a bar?
How about if you talk to your boss and after she lands, if she tells you it's all right to provide her contact information to me, you can do so.
This is a liar. Don't trust me. Don't give out your personal information. This is a liar. Don't trust me. Don't give out your personal information. This is a liar. Don't trust me. Don't give out your personal information.
I imagined that that was the case, and that's why I interacted that way. On the other hand, I do know people that approach me with similar propositions who are telling the truth. So the way I discern between the truth and the lies is by asking for reasonable things in such a manner as to allow honest people to communicate effectively and liars to reveal themselves. I appreciate that you revealed yourself. And I strongly hope that you will decide to stop lying in the future. However, I suspect that you are either an automated mechanism or a person who's being forced to do this. And if it is the latter, I am sorry that you're in that situation and wish I could help you get out of it. And if it is the former, that I hope your automated mechanisms will learn from this experience so I can enjoy the next attempt to use deception.
Here's the real problem. I suspect this is an attempt to train users away from giving personal information. But the real net effect is to waste my time. If this is the case, I hope we have a class action suit to recover the billions of dollars of wasted time for millions of people being abused by this process. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. We're back with Bob. And he had just made headphones out of a hanger and a child's toy and some cotton balls when he was less than 10 years old. So what was your next experience with cyber?
Not a whole lot of anything because my future was supposed to be manual labor, working in shops, driving flatbed trucks, that kind of stuff, working with tools. I did a job where we built water beds back in the 80s when water beds were the big thing.
All right, hang on. You built water beds. How do you build a water bed?
Well, we didn't build the bladder. We built the wood frames for it, the headboard, footboard, all that stuff.
Sure. Got that part. All right.
Yep.
All right. So at some point, your life changed. So what happened?
Well, I grew up very poor. And when you grow up poor, life sucks. Money is not to be made anywhere, not to be had anywhere. So your options, again, were very limited. You're going to spend your life as manual labor. You're not going to go to college. And plus, I wasn't fit to go to college at that age because I was too rambunctious. And so I decided to join the Army. I joined the Army when I was 17 years old. I enlisted when I was 17. And I actually joined in the month after I turned 18. But I signed up.
When you joined the Army now, just walk us through the experience of joining the Army in that era. What did you go through the stuff that we hear about on Alice's Restaurant with the all that stuff or not?
It was very different for me because I signed up to become an Army Airborne Ranger. There are three range battalions in the world, and I signed up to go to the one at Fort Lewis, the 2nd Ranger Battalion. So I had to have met all these, I had to have done all these things to get to the Ranger Battalion. For example, I had to make it through infantry basic training and advanced infantry training. I had to make it through airborne school. I had to make it through what they call the Ranger Indoctrination Program. And then you have to actually make it to the Ranger Battalion and survive there.
So when you originally signed up, was that your intent or you decided that after you were on the way?
No, that was my intent from the very beginning. I figured if I was going to come in the military, I wanted to be the best.
So when you signed up for that, if you wouldn't have made it through each step of that, you would have ended up in some other grunt job. But you did. Is that basically it?
Exactly. In fact, the recruiter was laughing his ass off when I signed the contract, especially when I came back about 2 years later, and he tells me, he goes, you weren't supposed to make it. Yeah. He goes, 1 out of 400 people try and make it. You weren't supposed to make it. I'm like, well, sorry.
I suspect what you said is that you're not supposed to make it, sir?
No, I was enlisted. I came in the Army as an E1. I was at such a low rank that I owed rank.
Below buck private. Okay.
Yeah, you are the worm of the earth. Which is great because you can get away with a lot more, and plus you have that license to learn. People don't expect anything.
So by the time you made it to Ranger School, what were you? Were you still?
I was an E4 at the time. When you're in the Ranger Battalion, you have to wait your turn to go to Ranger School because they only have so many slots for each class. So you're basically, you prove yourself as a active duty Ranger, doing the missions, doing all the training, doing all the stuff. And then when your slot comes up, you go to Ranger School. And one thing you don't do is you don't wash out of Ranger School. That is the cardinal. Well, it's not allowed. It's frowned upon, and they kick you out of the Ranger Battalion if that happens.
Oh, so if you don't pass, I mean, so when you say you don't get kicked out or you don't quit, I mean, so I don't understand. Some people must not make it through Ranger School, right?
It happens quite a bit, but not all of them. There's very, very few people that are actually in a Ranger Battalion. So a lot of people that go to Ranger School are just going for the school to get the Ranger tab. They're not going to do the actual job of an Army Airborne Ranger.
And what is the job of an Army Airborne Ranger, or was the job at that time?
We were a quick reactionary worldwide deployment special operations unit. Basically, we were deployable anywhere in the world in 19 hours. So we had different jobs that we did depending on what our specialty was. Just like anything else, where they basically throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. So we're going to train you up on all this different stuff, and along with that, everybody else around you is also trained up on a whole bunch of different stuff. So what happens is anytime there's any downtime or we're waiting for something, they'll say, okay, Ranger Monroe, give a class on the Claymore mine. Okay, so fine, I'll give a 5-minute class. Or they'll say, Ranger Hershaw, you just went to air assault school, give a 5-minute class on repelling from a helicopter. So you're always learning. You're always getting firsthand experience from somebody who had just done it or gone through the course, or you've gone through the course yourself.
Interesting. All right, so you got through Ranger School, I take it?
Yes.
And when you got through, what rank or what level were you then?
I was an E4 when I went to Ranger School. In a few months later, I pinned on E5. After I graduated, I pinned on E5. I had gotten married at that time.
So hang on. What is E5?
That's a sergeant.
Sergeant. Okay. So you get out, you're a sergeant. You're still not somebody they say sir to. That takes one more step, right?
It takes another step or two.
Yep. But you got married. So how... Okay, so many memes in there, right?
So many.
So my favorite, oh my goodness, they're thrilled, but I love it, license to learn. You know?
Right.
It's you think about, you know, James Bond, right? License to kill. No. License to learn. You know? Anytime you have nothing to do, you can immediately get a 5-minute lesson in something completely different.
Yay. What I can't help noting is just the driven nature of it, right? And there's so much of that in life, in business, and in cyber and cybersecurity, and all the careers of you and I and everybody, you know, we know. You know, there has to be a reason, has to be a crunch, right? And Bob had a lot of crunch and a lot of motivation, and he, you know, loved the path he's taken so far. And yeah, you drive to it. You put yourself in a situation where, again, you end up being interviewed for a show like this because you've had an interesting life.
Well, I think it's not just that you've had an interesting life. It's the craziness of the path, right?
Right.
And so another one, you know, you're not supposed to make it.
You know? You're not supposed to make it. That's right. You're
not supposed to make it. No, I'm sorry. Right. You misunderstood. No, I am going to make it. I don't care what you think I'm supposed to do.
I'm just sitting here thinking right now, and I don't know if outside of the cybersecurity world, imposter syndrome is such a well-known term, right? You know, but I think it is such an endemic thing among our community, because so many of us, you know, over and over again, we show up somewhere and it's like, we're not really sure we're supposed to be here. You know, was there an official way to get here? We didn't do that. You know, we got here through this, you know, 5 steps to the side, 2 forward, you go down that hallway, wait 5 seconds, go through that door. And all of a sudden you're...
There's a little bit more to it, right? So you're always facing... Well, no, but you're always facing a new situation.
Right.
Right. So it's not... You know, if you're driving a truck, you know, no offense to truck drivers, but, you know, basically driving a truck is the same thing all the time unless there's an accident, right? I mean, there's just like... You steer, you use the brakes, you use the gas, you go up. I mean, it's not that there's nothing to it. There's, you know, lots of skill involved, and you got to know what you're doing, and there's something to develop. But it's not like you're driving the truck and all of a sudden the helicopter comes and picks up the truck, right? That's just not going to happen driving a truck, maybe in the movies, but certainly not on the road. And it's the same with most jobs, I think, right? Limited stuff will happen to you. And when it happens, you know, if you don't know what to do, you know, somebody else will help you figure it out. And then there's a set of people who I think I call it, you know, get it done. You know, it just people that just get it done. Whatever it is that happens, they're going to say, oh, well, there must be a way to do that. I'll do that. So there's the get it done people. And the get it done people, in my experience, also have some of this gene that says, find a way around it, right? And that's what we're talking about with the headphones that he made, right? When he was, and we'll hear more about what this is, but you know, just sort of refuse to say, you know, I'm going to fail, I'm going to pass, and that's all there is to it. But the other one that hit me was the anywhere in the world in 19 hours, not 18 hours. Just by the way, in 19 hours. Right. So they have it timed down so they know just exactly, you know, how long it is. It's going to take. Right. So
longer or less.
Yeah. President's involved. Right. The president knows 19 hours you can do this. Right.
Right.
So somewhere
you throw into that character mix, you know, cybersecurity, you know, and again, security at all, you know, nice conflict. You know, so you take someone who's, you know, a fiddler and a fixer and so forth and say, oh, by the way, you now have an adversary, someone who is actively going to try to break everything you're doing. So it's, huh, you know, so now it's a never-ending battle, isn't it? You know, it's not just about getting the rails laid and getting the trains going. It's about finding out how, you know, they derailed the last one, making that not happen again, knowing that they're still out there, right? So there's this, you know, endless tinkeriness to it, right? And then there's a certain character of folks, and it's a very broad demographic, right? And to be clear, to be out there, if you don't feel that you fit this, don't be discouraged. You know, the you cannot tell a cybersecurity person by looking at them. We look like everybody. It's just amazing.
Right. Then there's this eternal learning thing, right? So here's a guy that has, you know, C grades in high school, but obviously he's a learning machine. You know, he's obviously bloody smart, but it's not in the way that high school makes you appear smart. Right? It's a completely different thing. And by the way, I think there's lots and lots of people like that that end up not moving forward in their lives, end up in these sorts of jobs that he talks about because their smart is somewhere else, right? And for, I mean, look, anybody that builds stuff, you build boats, right, that you live in. Anybody that builds stuff, there's a smart there, right? It's a different smart than reading, writing, and arithmetic.
School days, dear old golden rule days, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick.
And like I was saying about, you know, the Industrial Revolution sort of approach is good enough, and 70% efficiency is fine, right? When you're just digging dirt out of the ground, turning into metal and steel and stamping into things, you know, that are better than, you know, slapping a mule on the butt. But, you know, in our education system in our era, you know, has been the same sort of thing. If you can educate 70% of the kids, pretty good, you know, then heck, you're winning. Now, 30%, you know, in the modern era is kind of, you know, sad look at it. I think, you know, the public education system needs to catch up, but yeah.
Well, but let's also remember,
has been acceptable. So, you know, the differently talented or, you know, just not fitting the mold the last half century haven't really been utilized.
Let's also remember that in that time frame, people were graded on the curve. So a C is quite literally the middle, the average, right? So he performed the average in high school at the set of things that you're teaching them in high school. But he gets into the Ranger Battalion, and he's, you know, 1 in 400, right? So he's like, you know, 4 or 5 sigma off a center when it comes to that stuff, right? Learning stuff that's relevant, not book learning necessarily. I'm sure there's plenty of book learning involved. But, you know, book learning where, oh, if I don't do this right, somebody's going to die. I'm going to learn it, right? And where you have that practical application, right? It's like, it's much easier to learn geography if you're going there. You know, say, yeah, what's the building material made of? Well, I have no clue. Oh, I'm going to have to break in through the wall. Ah, well, what's it made of? Let's find out, right? So, and now I'm going to know just how that stuff works, right? Because I have to do it. So that practical application drives Bob to superior performance. And the other thing is the license to learn, man. You're just always... Somebody comes back from training, 5 minutes. They're going to teach you in 5 minutes what they just spent the last hour, day, week, or so doing. And you're not going to be as good at it as them instantly, but you're going to know enough about it so that, you know, in a survival situation, you can do it. And probably you'll know enough about it so that when they do it next to you, you'll understand what they're doing and not do something stupid.
Well, and the values of those micro doses of information, you know, can't be understated. You know, like with recurring meetings, working group meetings, you know, I pay a lot of attention to this one because I think it's when you say, like, at the end of a meeting, okay, you know, here's something to think about. We'll talk about it next week or whatnot. And then you come back together next week and you're talking about it. Even though it was 5 seconds, and it was like a couple of words at the end of the thing, it's embedded in everyone's brain. And they've been chewing on it the whole time somewhere back in their, so when you bring it up, it's not the same as if you just bring it up again. So that a little bit of training is can be extremely useful. It soaks in.
Yeah, it's you're preloading, right? It's called priming. You know, you're priming your mind on that, and you'll dream about it. You'll think about it. You'll integrate it into other things. In fact, this is one of the reasons that, you know, these courses that you take over 8 hours or 16 hours on 1 or 2 days over a weekend,
they're just, you're not going to learn the same way or the same things. You're going to learn if you take that a couple hours a day over a period of weeks. And a lot of stuff, you need to think about it, right? They told you about it, you saw it, you read it. You need to think about it a little bit and let that sink in before you're ready for the next dose. And I think it's one of the problems with the way we expect people to learn. And also, one of the great things about, you know, the working on the cybersecurity gigs that we've worked on, and effectively, you're showing up somewhere you've never been before and you're looking at stuff. Everything you see is something you haven't seen that before, but you've seen something similar. And then there's stuff you've never seen before. So it's all micro doses of what is that? How does that work? Wow, how does that fit into my model of the world? Take notes on it, write it down. And then later on, you're going to analyze it and you're going to talk to other people doing it with you, right? And they're going to, you know, between you and them, you're going to write a report and you're going to learn from them and they're going to learn from you. And microdose after microdose. So anytime you go on one of these gigs, you know, one of these physical gigs we've been on, you probably see 100 things in a day, you know, 50 of which you've not quite experienced before. And they're going to tell you what happened to them. And you've probably heard, the first time you go out, you've heard none of it. After you've done it for a couple of years, you've heard 60 or 70% of it. After you've done it for 30 or 40 years, you've heard 80 or 90% of it. Still new stuff pops up, but it's the same kind of stuff. But those micro doses, that little bit of knowledge here and there is just fabulous. And one of the things I love about it.
Well, you recall an engagement. You and I was there on the ground. You were remote and I was there with a couple of colleagues in a small, resource-rich second world country that had infrastructure issues. And, we're talking about a planning going down. You know, that's what I want to do. It's like, I want to walk around. I want to walk around and see that. I want to, you know, drive around. You know, let's, right? It's a small country. Let's drive around the whole thing. Let's walk around and poke at it. You need to see what it looks like. What are people doing? You know, and again, with the team we had, it was perfect. You know, with you on the, you know, on the process side, capturing, as you say, it's like, you know, let's walk through the set of questions we'd expect to ask. Make sure we ask those. Just see, find out where things are. And our colleagues, you know, we got a really good look at it. But as you say, it's just a matter of walking up and looking at it. I don't know. Hadn't been there before. But I can tell you a lot about it now. And a lot of it is I learned, you know, having looked at it and talked to some people and thought about it. And, you know, it sinks in more than gets, you know, machine tooled.
Yeah. Also that combined experience, right? The physical part of it is really important. The other thing is when we do these studies, of an enterprise, for example, we don't need to see every location. What we want to see is a representative sample. So one of every kind. And we want to talk or more. And we want to talk to people who are the people that actually do it. So, you know, it turns out I've done this for some awfully large enterprises. And even the largest enterprises, you know, they may have 20 or 30 different things they do, 20 different kinds of facilities or something like that. But that's it. That's just, you can see 20 or 30 things and you know basically everything going on. And you can talk to 20 or 30 people and you will have seen 90, 95% of everything anybody in that company does.
Right. You know, I've said this about AI on another show, another venue recently, but, you know, security people can say, look, if you hack this AI thing, it might, sneak up and steal our kidneys in the middle of the night. And sure, that's possible. If I look at it and I say, you know, like this issue, you know, security assessments have been problematic, you know, for decades. You know, it's basically very difficult to extract by human means the information you need to get a really, really detailed look at an organization. And then, you know, it produces a lot of information that gets really, really hard to get, you know, that organization to digest and do anything about. It's just true. You know, I see, you know, these AI, large language model tools as ways to plow through that. Like, you know, it can really produce, you know, just reduce that time to transparency again so that we can, you know, see some things that are going on and make some choices.
You're talking about the AI analytical tools, not the generative tools, right?
Yeah. You know, and again, you know, I know we don't have the things I'm thinking about now. I'd be surprised if we don't have some of them in 5 years, and I think it's closer than that. You know, the ability to gather all the data, you know, it's the recurring theme, right? Whether we're talking about the movement of S-bombs and next step of that, you know, my software bill of material inventory document you know, flowing downstream from somewhere in my supply chain, mating up with an indicator of compromise, an IOC document coming from some nation state that I'm, you know, that I'm in or whatnot, and how do I put all this information together, and how long does it take? The GitHub attack, right? You know, the last on February 29th, you know, there was a fork all the way down, sort of exploit that caused a lot of problems. I've been asked about that, and I get the same sort of answer, right? You know, we tend, you know, when something's really exploitable, it's because, you know, the conditions are fertile for exploits, which usually means about the same time the conditions are probably fertile for defenses, you know, that that have been thought through and talked through and maybe even started, but hadn't been funded or hadn't been, you know, a necessary thing, and those get put in place. And they all look like transparency and visibility to me, because that's how you save the time to either get inside the OODA loop of your enemy, your adversary, or to save money.
Yeah, OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, act. The Boyd cycle from a fighter pilot, last name Boyd. And guess what Bob ended up doing? We'll see in the next session.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
VintSurf is one of the best known early internet ARPANET developers, researchers, and one of the folks that's considered by many as one of the founders of the internet as it exists. He has continued to work over many years for a variety of companies and doing a variety of different work related to forming networks. Here's Vint.
We're back with Vint. And so your first experience with computers was with tubes. So not the earliest computers, but, you know, a little bit later. So tell us from there forward, what happened?
Well, you know, with actually, the tubes and what next? If you're making a distinction between the tube-based machines and the mechanical ones, I was using calculators before that, you know, serious ones like Marchant, for example.
Okay. So you lied about your first encounter with computers, with cybernetic systems, by telling us it was tubes. So go back in time. What was your first encounter with cybernetic systems with mechanical calculators then?
Well, that's assuming that you think of a mechanical calculator as cybernetic, and I don't.
Well, sensors, actuators, communications, and control, right? Input, output, state.
Yeah, you could say that. Anyway, the thing is that the human being who's using the calculator is very much in that loop, and it's part of the computation.
Yeah, so, well, but people are using computers, the tube computers, in the same way as part of calculations, just not every step in the calculation. So the mechanical devices were also programmable, right?
Not that I remember. The ones I was using, you did all the computations yourself. You were just getting it to do the arithmetic, but you had to decide what the equations were and what numbers to put in and when to do an add or a subtract or a multiply.
I see. So you didn't have the ones with the wires to reconnect the way things worked.
No, I was trained to do that with the programmed printing systems from IBM. When I went to work for IBM in 1965, I went to systems engineering school, and they forced us to learn how to do plug boards together to make a circuit that would do a computation, taking input from a punch card reader and producing output on a printer.
All right, so these were essentially reprogramming punch card to printer systems.
That's correct. But that was 1965, and that's way after my first encounter with the Sage, tube-based machine. And that was after my encounter with the Marchant calculators and filling out spreadsheets and things. So I really didn't get to the opportunity to program a computer until 1961. At which point I got access to a Bendix G15 paper tape printer, or calculator, or computer, really. It was normally used for numerical control, but my best friend Steve Crocker and I used it to do transcendental equation calculations.
So just for clarity, transcendental calculations are not the same as transcendental meditation, right?
That's correct. This is more a question of 2 to the x equal x to the, you know, e or something like that. We did those calculations, and then shortly after that, we got access to an IBM 7090, which is a serious piece of equipment. Then I went on to run a time-sharing system on an IBM 7044.
So wait, what programming languages were you using, and were you toggling things into the console? And tell us more about the experience.
Well, as certainly with the 7044, the way you got it started was to toggle in a small program to read the first punched card, which had itself a program in the punched into the columns, which is
to read the next card.
Yeah, basically, that's right. So that was a machine language.
Yeah, so you were bootstrapping. You did a couple of instructions to bootstrap, and then come to the second level bootstrap with the first card, and then card after card. And eventually, you would come up. But you were always running in not even assembly language. This was just the machine codes.
Well, the machine code was needed on the punch card, but then all the programs I ran were written in assembly language.
Oh, so how did it get translated into more punch cards with machine language?
Well, it had to go through essentially a compiler of the assembly language code.
Yeah, so it's an assembler is what they used to call it, right?
Yes. So I had an assembler for the IBM 7044, and all the operating system work for this time-sharing machine was written in assembly code, which I had to learn to debug and fix bugs in and so on.
Then, what was the name of the operating system?
It was whatever IBM was running on the 7044. I'm not sure that it had a special name. It might have, but I don't remember it if it did.
Fair enough. Okay. So continue on. All right. So your first program. So what did you program? What did you write programs to do?
Well, apart from the transcendental equations on the Bendix 315 and the time sharing system, the time sharing system actually ran a compiler for Fortran 2. So people could remotely write software in Fortran 2 and then submit it to be compiled and executed on the time-sharing system. And this was 1995.
When you said remotely, were they using a terminal or were they using cards? Were they punching it and sending it to you? How was that working?
They actually used an IBM 1050 golf ball terminal that was plugged into an acoustic modem. Then you dial up the computer center. The 7740 machine would accept the call. And then you would type whatever it is you wanted to type using the 1050, launch the program, and then the results would be typed back at you when the run was complete.
Yeah, so this is significantly after the punch card era where you brought it up to the glass thing and said, here's my punch cards, and they did whatever they did, and you got the printout, and then you had to look at it and figure out.
So the answer is yes and no. I mean, in 65, running a time-sharing system was moderately unusual. It was new. Time-sharing was invented in MIT around 61 or so on a PDP-1. So that IBM was running a time-sharing machine on a 7044 was pretty amazing. When I was at Stanford as an undergraduate, we were still submitting jobs on the Burroughs machines there using punch cards. And getting our output an hours later, that eventually changed, of course, to the kind of online interactive programming that we do today.
Right. All right. So the punch cards and the remote teletype with the loud. Well, you had the golf ball moving around, which was much better than the louder ones that were like that.
I used those too. I had a teletype model 28 that I used on a dial-up modem to program a time-sharing system front end for the UNIVAC 1108. This is
right. So you said a time-sharing system front end. So let's just understand, were you doing systems program all this time, or were you doing applications other than your
systems programming? We're designing and building operating systems, basically, that were time-shared in their character. In my case, in 65 at the beginning, and then 68 for this time-sharing machine that we ran on an Interdata Model 4, I think, which interfaced to an 1108. So you would interactively compose a program on the time-sharing system, then submit a batch job to the 1108 UNIVAC machine, and it would run the job and then send the results back out, and they get a printout from your teletype.
So time-sharing was just for setting up the jobs and putting in your programs and getting the answers.
That's right.
So were you doing, when you say, talk about the operating system level, were you doing memory allocation and disk storage? And all those sorts of things. What sorts of things were you doing at the operating system? And did you do microcode as well?
Well, I did do some microcode as well. The IBM had the new 360 series, and a lot of that ran with microcode. And so we would, it would emulate older machines. And so I would was running, for example, another computer game. It was a batch-driven computer game. People would form groups, and they would emulate running a company. And we'd have competitors of three or four companies running. Carnation Company wanted to have its executives learn how to run a company. And so Steve Crocker and I would have this game that we would run for the trainees. And the game was originally written in an assembly language that was being interpreted by a microcode on an IBM 36040. And every year that we ran this, it would be on a different machine. Eventually, we decided this multiple emulation thing was silly, and we rewrote the whole thing in Fortran. But that was another experience that I had with writing software.
What was the name of the game, by the way, or did it have one?
It didn't have a name for the game necessarily, but it was basically, you know, the Carnation Company's emulation of a competitive company environment. People would make widgets and frobs and some other thing, and they'd compete with each other. They'd have to decide how much to put into R&D, how much to put into marketing, how much to put into inventory.
Asset allocation, and so it's sort of like Age of Empires, except much older version.
It was much simpler in terms of the number of different parameters that you could run, and the winner is the one that made the most money at the end of the game.
Yeah, so you did some sort of an optimization to figure out what the answers produced. So was there game theory behind it at all, or how did you do
the calculation? Game theory, of course, is heavily strategic, and this was more like just a model of what would happen depending on what the various competitors chose to do in each of their territories and in competing in common territory. How much did the R&D reduce the cost of the product so they could increase margin? What about scale? You know, if they made 1 million widgets, was it less expensive per widget than if they made 100,000? So there were models that with parameters in it that were plugged in. There wasn't any optimization in the more classic sense. We weren't doing a linear programming optimization or anything like that.
Fascinating. All right, let's take a little break.
There's just so much in there.
So I just wanted to start out by clarifying that it was using a Model 28 to talk to the Innerdata Model 4 to talk to the UNIVAC 1108, but there was also the 1040 talking to the 1050, talking to the 7074 at 2400 baud, and then there was the PDP-1 and the 36040. So I just wanted, because you might have been confused about the 1108 versus the 7074.
But again, at the time, you know, in the industry, you know, these are the numbers, the names you would know, right? You know, it's like talking about, you know, Pentium, whatever, chipsets and servers and, you know, racks and the way we talk about it today. But, you know, so many things, you know, but let me start with, I was born in 1965, right? You know, in 1968, my dad started working at IBM. So I grew up getting boxes of cards with those programs, with those languages. You know, subdivided in some way, if I could, you know, I was very, very young at the time, but it seems to me that there were, like, in a box sometimes, literally, it might have been a whole stack, like Ben was talking about, where the first card is the one to you know, boot the machine up to the point that it's doing something, and this next bit, you know, the compilers, the assembler, and then you get into this, you know, creating this space, and you follow that arc back a little further to, you know, World War II, you know, as you're talking about the transition from mechanical to digital and so forth with Alan Turing and Bletchley Park and all that. So now we're to, you know, move it forward 20 years, and there's been, and, you know, Steve Crocker and, you know, a small group of people who are just in the right time, the right place, following that arc and saying, all right, you know, connect these things together. And then in the late 80s, you know, I'm out there with a MUX multiplexer and you connecting, you know, 36 hardware stores across the US to two 3D6s, you know, and multiplexing these little digital lines at 14K baud, right? You know, that was the, you know, limit at the time, right? And they just point along the line, and it's just endlessly fascinating. And again, the people involved, I hope I don't sound too fawning to say this, but I just love my friends so much, right? It's just such an odd privilege to get to know all these people who are great folks themselves. Like, you know, yes, it's a certain amount of circumstantial. You had to be in the right place at the time. You couldn't have gotten here. However, right. You know, what a fascinating set a pass, you know. And I think it reinforces all my thoughts about the driving, not just philosophical, but technical and business, as we talked about economic structure of all this. Turns out, you know, connecting things together and sharing information and connecting people and so forth is more efficient, more effective for all the problems it may bring. And it's a arc towards justice.
So, you know, here's the thing. Every one of these numbers pops a picture into my mind.
I'll bet it does. I
touched each one of those things. So, right. You know, Model 28, you know, I have this whole picture in this beautiful plastic beige thing with the circular keys, and you push on them and there's positive feedback and they go, you know, and the paper scrolling out and you know, it's connected to, and there's this modem that you plug in. I had a phone and you plugged it into the modem and you know, 2400 baud, it syncs up and it goes like that. And you know, I used to be able to whistle in there to start the protocol with, you know, by just whistling. I mean, all this craziness of how it worked. It's almost like flashbacks.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine. For somebody,
Ben was talking, I can smell those cards. As a 3-year-old kid, 3, 4, 5 years old, you know, we would take those cards. You'd make house of cards, you know, massive house of cards in the Arvada, Colorado, in the basement, with those same cards, with all that information, all those chads taken out, you know, that is literally contained in the programming. That if not derived from what Vint and, you know, people were working on, were, you know, that same bunch of folks, you know, their bunch of colleagues. Making all sorts of programs to do things, ending up being my Christmas plaything. And you would staple them into and spray paint them gold and make Christmas wreaths out of them. So we had all that data inside Christmas wreaths, you know, and garland on them. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we wax poetic about the good old days, but there was, you know, really nothing all that good about all that noise and all that stuff. But, you know, here it was. And the other thing about it is that I don't think that my children, and I'm certain that my grandchildren will, other than the radio show and maybe going to the Computer History Museum, you know, will never have a concept of what that life was like. And it's just like I've been to the Henry Ford Museum and seen cars from the early 1900s, you know, and the notion that you're part of history now, you know, makes you feel older.
You know, in the Adventure Time series that I love so much, you know, the final episode of the main series, you know, this one, you know, sweet character sings this great song, you know, this, you know, and about the end of things, right? You know, and it's okay. You know, time is illusion that helps us make sense. You know, so we're all living in the present tense. But really, as you look at everything, yes, you know, if you look at all your lives, all of our lives, or all of, you know, history, future, and back, there's always, everything's will happen, happening happened, right? And it's just true, right? And it doesn't lessen things that things come to an end, right? You know, the arc continues. We're part of something that, you know, has been going on for a couple billion years, but in our little sentient world for hundreds of thousands of years. You get those Lincoln logs, you know, I just picture this person, this pre-Homo sapiens, this Homo erectus person, you know, ruled the world for 1.5 million years, not bad. You know, being out there and saying, you know, if I take these two things, I change their features and I put them together into a system, you know, that makes my life better in some way. You know, was it fishing perch? What was it? I don't know. But it was, you know, somebody doing the same thing that we do today. It sounds, to sound my age, it sounds like the classic, you know, stereotype of American dad on a weekend. You know, I got my skill saw right here. I got some lumber. What can I build? And we're just still doing it. And it builds out. It's beautiful. Look at what we've built, right? You know, and for all our risk to the environment and everything else, we're also its only hope. You know, the life on this earth will end in 1 or 2 years when the sun heats up enough, unless, you know, humans figure it out and take life with us. You know, we are the hope for all of it.
So that's actually a wonderful thing to talk about. And we're going to be talking about that later on when we go through some of the rest of what Vint's going to talk about, because, you know, the protocol that allows you to communicate next door maybe allows you to communicate to Alpha Centauri.
Exactly.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on the Cyber Show, Bob MacGyver Monroe survives contact with the enemy. Vint has limited memory and uses Petri nets. Well, not exactly
Petri nets. It's actually, well, a less restrictive Petri net to do it. What the heck was he was going to do with them anyway? Another pitcher tries to slide one past us. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A strange beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.